CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast.
And now here's your host, Carrie Baptist.
Good evening. In the news this week, Vancouverites rallied in support of the Mobile Access Program van, a van that provides mobile essential services to those in the sex trade. Liberal leader Michael Ignatieff spoke at a vigil for Iranian protesters, and the Assembly of First Nations launched a human rights campaign against the federal government. We'll have all this, plus your weekend weather forecast, coming up in the next hour, right here on News 101. For the past 10 nights, crowds have been gathering in front of the Vancouver Art Gallery to silently stand in solidarity with the pro-democracy protesters in Iran. Producer Megan Turcato attended a vigil and brings us this report.
Well, everyone at the vigil was there to stand in solidarity with the protesters in Iran. Many expressed different points of view about what they wanted these vigils to achieve. I spoke with several Iranian-Canadian SFU students who hoped global pressures would eventually lead to greater democracy in Iran. I started by asking what type of outcome they wanted to see for Iran.
The regime suddenly changes their mind and they accept people's vote and respect that, so that somebody like Mousavi, who is a reformist candidate, could be in the office as the president. But this is not our final goal. We are actually hoping to see much more changes in Iran. Actually, well, you see, if you just look at the structure, the power structure in Iran, it is totally not democratic. We are hoping that somehow, in a way, a president who has who is a very popular president like Mousavi can do something about it. I mean, they can probably change our constitution in a way so that it would be more democratic and not just seeking towards dictatorship. Well, you see, we have this, as many of the people right now know, we have this supreme leader who is not elected. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing that violates democracy.
For one of the student organizers, Siavash Ropni, a good outcome would simply be an end to the violence. Peace, which he hopes will facilitate discussion on what a new Iran will look like.
I would like to see people not getting beaten anymore. Mm-hmm. I would like to see no violence. I would like to see a dialogue and a resolution to this conflict in a more peaceful manner. You know, it is a conflict that has started, and there are other options for resolving the issue, and the best option is the option that involves least violence, mm-hmm. and that is dialogue. You know, if we speak to each other for 100 years, we would not damage as much as having one day of violence, mm-hmm. you know.
Another SFU student organizer, Sitari, pointed out that it was not up to us here in Canada to prescribe what form a new Iran should take. In her view, we can only support those asking for change.
As the diaspora population of as the diaspora Iranian population in Canada or Canadians as a whole, I don't believe that it's our job to stop anything. I think it's in the hands of the people of Iran to basically change their destiny. All we can do is stay one step behind them and support them in whatever it is that they want. To not impose any ideas on them, to not claim that we know what the people of Iran want, mm-hmm. And therefore, prescribe what they should do to get there.
Organizers at the student vigil held last Wednesday at SFU discussed how they didn't want their protest to be used as an excuse to invade Iran.
We should be extremely conscious that our protest should not be in any way sabotaged to be used as a sort of justification for any sort of military intervention in Iran. That will be the last thing I think any concerned Iranian would want. So any sort of political pressure is more than welcome, but we should be extremely alert that our protests are not being sabotaged for any sort of military intervention.
Sitari echoed this view, saying the protesters were looking for solidarity, not intervention from foreign governments. I started by asking her what type of response she would like to see from the Canadian government.
that's a really tricky question, and we have come up with the answer that there's a very fine line between asking for support for the people and asking for the involvement of foreign governments in Iranian sovereignty. We don't want Iran to be liberated like Iraq and Afghanistan. That's very clear. But we do need other governments to recognize the human rights violations that are happening there, and hence take different foreign policy measures towards Iran. But we don't believe that sanctions, economic sanctions or war or military intervention of any sort, whether it's humanitarian or not, would be effective.
One vigil attendee, Michael, held a different view. He hoped the international community would take a more hands-on role in Iran.
Harper and Obama have very loud voices in the international world, and they need to speak out, and something has to happen in terms of embargoes or sanctions on the Iranian government. But right now what we have to do is raise the collective consciousness of everyone to put that type of pressure on our leaders.
As the 10 days wore on, the vigil at the Vancouver Art Gallery grew progressively larger. On the last night, Thursday, June 25th, many prominent government officials were in attendance, including Liberal leader Michael Ignatieff. I asked Siavash what he hoped to hear from Ignatieff.
It's a difficult question because it's actually upon Mr. Ignatieff to make his statement, but I would hope to hear that his party supports our cause, and I would like to hear him talking to the or bringing up the issue in the parliament as well. And I believe that the issue has already been in the parliament, but with Michael Ignatieff as the leader of the Liberal Party, I believe it would be a very strong voice in the parliament for him to speak on behalf of us.
Ignatieff was joined by Heritage Minister James Moore and NDP MP Libby Davies in addressing the assembled crowd. You'll hear Minister Moore followed by Ignatieff and Davies.
Well, first I want to thank all the volunteers and the organizers of tonight's vigil for putting this on and making the effort. Libby Davies is here. Michael Ignatieff is here. Michael, do you want to come on up? I know you're going to say a few words. You know, in the Parliament of Canada, we can have some profound differences on the left and on the right, but in moments like this, it's not about left and right, it's about right and wrong. And all of us in the House of Commons, we all recognize that there is a new Iran, a young Iran, a new Iran waiting to be born from this. And across all political parties, we call on the Iranian government to release all political prisoners, release the academics. Release the journalists. Let democracy work the way democracy is meant to work for the people of Iran. And I've been asked to keep this short, and because this is a vigil, I think the world needs to remember Neda. And just over here, there's a list of all the people who have been victims of what has happened in Iran. And before you leave tonight, take a look at those names of the people who have been imprisoned, the people who have been killed, the people who have been victimized. We need to always and always remember them. Iran is a beautiful, remarkable, incredible country with a beautiful and incredible future ahead of itself. And to all the Iranian community that has come together from across the Lower Mainland, from everybody from all walks of life who have come from across the Lower Mainland, to be here this evening. We stand together in a message of love to Iran, love for the future, and anger that this must not stand in a free and democratic world. This cannot happen. And we will stand shoulder to shoulder in Parliament, shoulder to shoulder, always for a democratic world and standing up for human rights. And because this is a vigil, I think it would be appropriate for those who have lost their lives to have a moment of silence for those victims. May peace and democracy always be in Iran's future. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Michael Ignacio.
Thank you. Thank you, James. I think the Iranian regime did not anticipate you. They thought that they could suppress the democratic rights of a people. They thought they could bully, beat, and intimidate the people of Iran, and the world would not care, the world would not watch, the world would not know. They did not anticipate you. They did not anticipate. They did not anticipate the courage of the Canadian-Iranian diaspora. They did not appreciate and understand what the internet allows us to know. They did not anticipate your determination, your anger, and your fury. Tonight we will be thinking hard about the people who have perished. We will be thinking hard about the people in Evin prison. I will be thinking about the people that I met in an incredible visit that I made to Tehran, to Isfahan, to Shiraz in 2005. I will think about the women at the university who said to me, I want to study law, I want to be a faithful follower of a great religion, but I want to be true in my fashion and in my way. I think of the university professors I met who wanted the simple freedom to teach what they knew to be true and to teach the books that they wanted to teach and not the books that they were told to teach by the regime. And I think most of all of a young man I met in a cafe in Isfahan on a Friday night, who after an hour screwed up the courage to tell me that what he was most afraid of was the possibility that he would have to go into the army, he would be forced into military service, and he would be beaten because he was gay. What he wanted to tell me was something at the center of this demonstration tonight. He wanted the freedom to be himself. And this is the most precious freedom of all the human freedoms. And this is the freedom we are defending tonight. The freedom to be yourself, the freedom to live in a free society. These feelings of freedom are deeply anchored, deeply rooted in the finest traditions of the Iranian people. And you represent the finest traditions of the Iranian people by being here tonight. You are also representing, and I will conclude with this, the finest traditions of Canadian democracy, the traditions that all parties here share. The tradition that says in Canada, if someone else cannot stand up for themselves, we must stand up for them. if someone cannot speak for themselves, we must speak for them. By your presence tonight, you've done honor to the Iranian community in Canada, you've done honor to the Iranian people, and you've done honor to Canada. Thank you very much.
Hello, everybody. My name is Libby Davies, and I'm a member of Parliament for Vancouver East. And I'm very proud to be here tonight with you, representing the New Democratic Party. I have to say that I almost didn't make it because it's very hard to find parking. There's so many of us here, and I kept driving by and seeing this amazing crowd. It looks quite beautiful from up here to see the candles and to see so many faces with such seriousness and with such dignity. So thank you for being here tonight. And you know, as I came here, I tried to remember how many times I have stood on these steps with many people on many different issues, protesting for a cause, for peace, for justice, for social justice. And it struck me as so fundamental that in Canada we take this right for granted. We assemble, we protest, we speak our mind, we speak out. And sometimes people get arrested for civil disobedience, but mostly we know that we can gather. We can be here to show our solidarity, whether it's something that's happening in Canada or around the globe. And so it's really horrifying to know that in Iran, when people are trying to do the same thing, to voice their feelings, their desire and goal and passion for democracy and for a fair election, and to see people brutalized and violated and killed and thrown in jail, makes us realize that as Canadians, we have a duty and a responsibility to stand up and make sure that we are part of the call in the international community to say that what is going on in Iran must stop, and people must be allowed to protest, people must be allowed to assemble, people must be allowed to express their human rights and their human dignity. We enjoy that right in Canada, and we want to see that worldwide, and we want to see it in Iran. You know, earlier today, I was at another rally about Iran, and it's a global solidarity day, today and tomorrow, called by the International Trade Union Council and other organizations representing 170 million workers globally. And they are having a day of solidarity for what has happened to workers in Iran and the rights of workers. And I think we should remember that today, the trade unionists who have tried to organize, to speak out, to defend their basic human rights as workers who are now in jail, and the teacher is still on death row. The bus drivers, you know, they're bus drivers, they're regular guys. They're in jail because they are trying to represent the legitimate demands of their members. And so I want you to know that around the globe, tomorrow, there are demonstrations of solidarity taking place in many capitals around the world in front of the Iranian embassy to say that the international labor community will not forget their brothers and sisters who have been jailed, whose rights have been stripped from them, who have been oppressed as workers, and nor will we forget that. It seems to me that the measure of any society, any democratic society, is one, how we treat our most vulnerable members in our society, but also how we treat the rights of workers and whether or not people can enjoy those fundamental issues of fairness to organize and to expect a fair wage and to live in dignity. Friends, I also want to say something about the women who have been participating in this struggle in Iran for rights and democracy, because to me, when I see those images that come from the cell phones, you know, and the internet is truly amazing in terms of how that information cannot be suppressed as hard as they try. They throw out the journalists, they jail the journalists, and yet the information still gets out. And the thing that has struck me is that the role that Iranian women are playing in this struggle for democracy. And I want to say, we stand with you, sisters. We stand with you. because we know that you overcome so many barriers in asserting your own rights in your own political and cultural community. And so here in Canada, the women of Canada, we stand with you and we salute what you're doing. And finally, friends, what I want to say is that the vigils that you are holding here are truly remarkable, and I agree with my colleagues, and I'm very happy to be here with my colleagues from all parties, and it's true that there are some issues that we can rise above and we can do the right thing, and I think this is one of these occasions. But to be part of this sense of solidarity globally and here in our own beautiful city of Vancouver, you know, this is something that has so much meaning and value. So I say thank you, and I want to tell you that our leader, Jack Layton, the NDP, we will continue to press the demands for democracy and human rights in Iran. We will continue to speak out with our colleagues in Parliament. We want to make sure that the Canadian government stands strong and tall and courageous in taking on this issue. We cannot be cautious. We have to know that it's one of those moments in history where we have to really build the solidarity and the momentum. So thank you so much for what you are doing. We're here to show our support and to continue that support until democracy and peace and justice are returned to Iran, and it's part of the international community for what we're all fighting for. Thank you so much.
Take a quick break, but stay tuned to CITR for more news following these public service announcements.
Donuts each and every
radio show
is brewed fresh and served fresh at the peak of its flavor. If you're a tough customer, only the taste of this
radio show
will do. So go ahead, let Dunkin' Donuts make your
radio experience
exquisite.
Indeed.
Dunkin' Donuts, serving sweet treats from the Pop Underground. Thursdays, noon to 1.
Come on, get a life. Spend 6 or 9 months getting involved in communities across Canada.
If you are between 17 and 21, not sure about your next step for college or university, want to meet people from all over Canada, and want to put something impressive on your resume, then listen to Those That Got a Life.
Check out gokatimovic.com. That's go, KATIMAVIK.com. Come on, get a life.
Hey, Quentin and Dave from Chips With Everything.
Hey, Heather from Queer FM, what's up?
Well, you know how Bryce, our program director here at CITR, has kind of been riding all of our asses about making promos for our shows?
Cha! Yes!
Well, you know, I was thinking, like, over at the CBC, they have this woman named Promo Girl, and she comes on once an hour and
yes.
tells everybody what's coming up, and it's usually kind of theatrical, and she has, like, a really sexy voice and stuff. So anyway, I was thinking that I'd really like to have a promo boy, or like, promo boys. Would you guys be up for that?
Sure. What do we have to do?
Just tell people about Queer FM, really.
Okay. Queer FM features news, views, current affairs, arts and music for, of course, the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered communities and all its allies. Heather Kitchen hosts Queer FM Sundays from 6 to 8 p.m. on CITR 101.9.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And welcome back to News 101. In national news, the Assembly of First Nations and the First Nations Child and Family Sharing Society launched a human rights complaint against the federal government this week. The organizations are alleging the federal government has inequitably funded child welfare services for First Nations children. We go to CHUO-FM's Lisa Abel for her interview with Cindy Blackstock, Executive Director of the First Nations Child and Family Sharing Society.
Since 1999,
the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada, has been promoting and supporting the work of First Nations Child and Family Service Agencies and regional organizations in Canada by providing research, professional development, and networking services. In 2007, the Caring Society and the Assembly of First Nations filed a complaint with the Canadian Human Rights Commission after research conducted by the Caring Society revealed that First Nations child welfare agencies receive approximately 22% less funding than provincial agencies. The Society's concerns were echoed in a 2008 report by the Auditor General of Canada that found that the federal government is not providing First Nations Child and Family Service Agencies with enough funding to meet the number or the needs of children in care. According to the Auditor General, the funding formula has not been reviewed since 1988, and it has not been adjusted for inflation since 1995, leaving First Nations Child and Family Services underfunded compared to provincial services. Since the human rights complaint was filed in 2007, the federal government has twice refused mediation and has been unwilling to discuss national solutions outlined in the Caring Society's Wende report and the AFN's 2006 Leadership Action Plan on First Nations Child Welfare. However, in October 2008, the Human Rights Commission decided that it would allow a tribunal to hear the human rights complaint regarding these First Nations children in state care. Cindy Blackstock, Executive Director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada, spoke about the human rights complaint last week with Lisa Abel, host of The Circle, a weekly Aboriginal issues program at CHUO 89.1 FM in Ottawa. This is their conversation. Today in the studio with me, I have Cindy Blackstock, Executive Director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Lisa.
Can you tell us some more about the organization, Cindy?
You know what? We're a very grassroots organization. We're the only national nonprofit that works specifically for Aboriginal children and families, and we have four staff. And one of the reasons we only have such a limited number of staff, given the needs of Aboriginal children, youth, and families across Canada, is that we have taken on active advocacy when it was needed to ensure that Aboriginal children have the same opportunities to live safely in their homes, go to schools that help support their cultural identity as every other Canadian child. And sometimes that doesn't make you that popular with funders, but you know what? Sometimes you got to stand up and do the right thing for kids, and that's what we're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. So I understand that you're having a fundraiser. It's a fundraiser with the Society, the Assembly of First Nations, and the National Association Friendship Center. It's called An Evening to Support First Nations Children and Families. So how come we need a fundraiser right now?
Well, you know what most Canadians don't understand is that First Nations children on reserve actually get less government money, both for elementary and secondary education and for child welfare. There are more First Nations children in child welfare care today than there was at the height of residential schools by a factor of three. For all those who said they wanted to do something to keep Aboriginal kids in their homes during residential school, your time is now. Mm-hmm. And one of the critical factors is that actually First Nations kids are less likely to be abused than non-Aboriginal children. It's
really?
Neglect. Yeah.
Mm.
Driven by things that are often outside of parental control, like poverty, poor housing, and caregiver substance misuse that can be linked back to residential schools.
Mm-hmm.
Given all that, you would think that at least equal funding would be provided for child welfare services on reserve, but that's not the case. You see, what happens in Canada is that provincial child welfare and education laws, they apply both on and off reserve. But the provincial governments expect the feds to pay up for services delivered to First Nations children and youth on reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And if the feds decide not to do that or do so inadequately, the provinces stand at the reserve line and say, oh, well.
Mm-hmm.
So we end up with these two-tiered child welfare systems. So for over 10 years, we've known that First Nations kids get about 22% less funding per child, even though they're about 10 times more likely to go into child welfare care. So we partnered with the Assembly of First Nations after we tried joint solutions with the federal government and they didn't implement them. We filed a human rights complaint against Canada. Now, this thing's historic. It's the first time the government of Canada will be held to account for its current treatment of First Nations children. So many people know about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission happening right now about residential schools, and that's really important. Well, we have this Canadian Human Rights Tribunal that is going to be about the contemporary treatment of First Nations kids by the Government of Canada. And we feel that tribunal, upon hearing all the evidence, is going to be convinced that A, the federal government is continuing to discriminate against First Nations children, and B, that discrimination is resulting in them being removed from their families at records levels that we've never seen before in history, including at the time of residential schools. So we're asking caring Canadians to come forward to help us fund that case, because what's so crazy about it is the federal government is trying to derail that tribunal. They don't want that tribunal to happen, and they're using legal technicalities to get out of that argument. We say it should be in our joint interest, the Government of Canada and First Nations, to have a full hearing on the facts. They can present all their case, we present ours. And that allows an independent body to make a decision about whether discrimination is happening. But the Government of Canada is using thousands and thousands of taxpayer dollars to fight to derail this tribunal. Hmm. And in fact, they're using many of the same lawyers they used in the residential school cases. So we're so thankful to the National Association of Friendship Centers and Peter Dinsdale, the executive director, for hosting this fundraiser to allow us the same kind of support so we can make sure that this case goes forward, that the Canadian public can hear for the very first time under oath and under subpoena Indian Affairs officials explaining how they're treating First Nations kids today.
Mm-hmm. Well, going back to what you were describing before, you were saying that there's 22% less funding. So what, like the organization, I know the Caring Society's, you've been engaged in a lot of really important research. So what are the impacts of this deficit in funding for these First Nations children?
You know what? You need to go no further than the Indian Affairs website. So in 2006, they had a fact sheet posted on their website, First Nations Child and Family Services fact sheet. And Indian Affairs itself says that its funding formula is linked to growing numbers of children going into child welfare care and First Nations agencies being unable to meet child welfare laws and responsibilities. So the Indian Affairs Department is already pointing to the fact that this lack of funding is linked to these kids going into foster care, in my view, unnecessarily. I think if they were given the same shot at being safely in their family homes, we wouldn't, there would be some First Nations kids in foster care for sure, mm-hmm. but not at record levels that we're seeing today.
Mm-hmm. So, wow, so less funding. So does that mean like they're bigger caseloads? Does it mean that?
It'll mean a number of things. At the level of the child, for example, I'll just give you one human example out of Manitoba. Mm-hmm. There was an agency that was serving on and off reserve. Off reserve, every child who died in care received a culturally based funeral. So a lot of kids will die naturally in care from cancer and other things. Mm. But if you were that same kid on reserve, there was no funding for a funeral. If you were off reserve and you were a baby, you got a safe crib according to the provincial child welfare funding, but no safe cribs for First Nations kids on reserve because the funding formula wouldn't adjust for that. It goes broader than that. The biggest gap is in services that are intended to keep children safely in their home. So as a child protection worker, you arrive at a family home, your first duty is to make the child safe within their family environment. But the funding formula that Indian Affairs has no services to provide for that. So removal or apprehension becomes the only resort instead of the last resort. And that's why during 1995 and 2001, we saw the number of status Indian kids on reserve going into child welfare care increase 71.5%. Highest here in Ontario, that was twice the national average, 164% increase.
That's amazing. So, but how has the government so far justified this lack of funding? Like, what reasons are they giving?
Well, the government is saying that they've launched this new approach, Alberta approach, and that they're making some progress. It has allowed for a little bit of extra funding in three provinces, but it's done nothing for First Nations children in the other seven provinces and the three territories. And we take the view that equality, when it comes to government funding, is a non-negotiable. Every child in this country is sacred. Aboriginal, First Nations, Métis, and Inuit, and non-Aboriginal children. And we shouldn't have to settle for partial equality. Well, these kids deserve the same level of investment, and probably even a little bit more because their needs are higher, than other non-Aboriginal children. So we take a different view than government. We don't think a little bit of equality is a good thing for First Nations kids. We actually think there's a reason why discrimination is not a determinant of health in this country and that equality matters.
Mm-hmm. So I guess perhaps when they decided that they would fund more Aboriginal-specific childcare services, did they think that was going to that was going to help solve some of the issues?
Well, I think it has solved some of the issues in that we know that despite the funding inequalities, First Nations kids served by an agency are about 4 to 5 times more likely to stay in their family and community than a similar child served by a provincial child welfare agency. But what we're not being able to get at is the kids on reserve aren't getting the same opportunity to stay safely in their homes because those services aren't available at the same rate as they are off reserve. So we have to deal with that deficit. The fact you can't just offload programs for First Nations and then cut the funding by 22% and expect equal results.
What kind of results are you hoping to see from this tribunal? Can you just like talk us through like what the process is for this
sure.
tribunal?
You know, a lot of people may not know the Canadian Human Rights Commission Tribunal is like a court process. So there are actually will be witnesses testifying, and certainly we've already filed our witness list, and we'll be calling a number of academic experts to testify to this, as well as we want INAC officials, in fact the minister himself, to speak to this whole underfunding policy in Child and Family Services. Also, Sheila Fraser, the Auditor General, the esteemed Auditor General, completed a report on First Nations child welfare. We're very much hoping that she'll testify as part of this process. So it's, we present our case, they present their case, and then the Commission makes a determination. A, whether there was a case of discrimination. Did discrimination happen in this instance as it's defined in the Canadian Human Rights Act? And if that did, they have the power to order a remedy that's enforceable in federal court. Now, we're asking, we've already got a solution called the Wande solution that would provide comparability and funding. If the federal government has something better, we're happy to look at it, but we want it implemented ASAP. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing we've asked for is a $112 million trust fund to be set up for the children who are wrongfully removed from their families. We feel that those kids are entitled to repatriation services funded by the federal government, cultural, language services, and in some cases, addictions counseling and personal counseling and wellness. So we'd like to see that resource be available to all the children who are affected by this underfunding for now over 20 years.
Well, that would make a real difference. There are like generations of children who have been in the child welfare system.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's really important that Canadians understand we are not talking about wanting to give First Nations kids a lesser standard of protection from abuse and neglect. We absolutely want them to be safe. But providing less funding for them doesn't help get there.
Mm-hmm.
And the federal government takes the position that throwing money at the problem won't solve it. Well, throwing money at funding inequalities has been known to help. And if we can afford to bail out multinational corporations, then I think we can afford equality for children. And what I'm looking for from the good leadership of the government is not so much shovel-ready projects. I'm looking for shovel-ready morality that really says that Canada is prepared to step up to the plate on its national values and understands that equality is for everyone, including, especially, vulnerable children and young people.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's quite a project, and it looks like you've been working on that for many years.
We've been working on it for many years, and you know, the sad thing is that the federal government is fighting so hard to not have this case heard before Canadians, and I can't understand that. I mean, if a year after the apology, if reconciliation means not saying sorry twice, then the federal government, I think, is duty-bound to at least allow all the facts to be heard before the Canadian public and allow some kind of decision to be made on this case. And I don't think this is a case that Canadians want resolved on a legal technicality. Mm-hmm. I think this is such an issue of moral consciousness of the nation that it is compelled to be a public hearing
right.
before an independent body, and I'm going to push for that as much as I possibly can.
The election for the chief of the Assembly of First Nations is taking place. What do you think that the candidates could be doing to address this?
Well, I think, you know, all chiefs across the country need to prioritize this issue because this human rights case is not only important in child welfare. Children are our biggest natural resources, more important than fish, trees, and mining. And number two, the implications of this case are huge. If we're successful, we're sending a message to the government of Canada that it is not at all possible to give First Nations children less simply because of who they are any longer. That will no longer be tolerated by the Canadian court system. And so this could have implications for equal funding in education, in housing, and in many other areas. So what we're asking the chiefs to do is a couple things. Number one is continue to voice your support. Educate community members that this case is happening because we're standing up for these kids in a way that maybe hasn't had an opportunity to happen before. And number three, if they can, and for your listeners too, to make a financial contribution to the human rights case for the lawyers. And it can be as little as 25 cents or as much as you possibly can. What's most important to me is this is our human rights case. Ours, as in all Canadians, have an interest and stake in this case. And as much as people can contribute and be involved, that's most welcome, including at the leadership level.
That's great. Well, Miigwech, Cindy Blackstock, for explaining this issue. I look forward to learning more about it in the future.
Well, thank you.
Thank you to Lisa Abel of CHUO-FM in Ottawa for that report. We're going to take another break now, but stay tuned and we'll be back with more news and new weather forecast here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
The UBC Ski and Snowboard Club is a nonprofit, democratic, student-run organization dedicated to promoting the sports of skiing and snowboarding and the associated lifestyle.
We endeavor to make skiing and snowboarding accessible and fun by actively seeking out the best deals and discounts for our members, as well as organizing trips to local ski areas and setting up numerous social events.
Come on one of our legendary trips and explore the glory of riding in British Columbia. Or join us at the bar to discover the true meaning of debauchery. Ask your roommate, ask your parents, ask the RCMP. Who has the most fun at UBC? You'll get the same answer. The Ski and Snowboard Club.
Yeah. Joining the Ski and Board Club is easy. Come by our office, sub 115, anytime with some money to become a member. Your membership gives you access to all the deals offered by our sponsors. Cheap beverages at our parties, an invitation to all club events, and of course, only members can come on the trips. Yeah.
Vancouver Folk Music Festival, July 17th to 19th at Jericho Beach Park. Come discover over 60 artists from 14 countries, including The Weaker Thans, Iron and Wine, Great Lake Swimmers, Arrested Development, gospel legend Mavis Staples, Jeff Burner, and more. Tickets and information available online at www.thefestival.bc.ca and at outlets throughout the city.
Sometimes I'd like to take a peppermint and a switchblade and a Cadillac and throw it all in a fire.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Radio for crazy people and the elderly. Oh, yeah.
Welcome back to News 101. The time is 5:43. This weekend, Vancouverites took to the streets to protest the loss of the MAP van, a program that provides essential services to sex trade workers in Vancouver. The service is funded by the province and run by the organizations WISH and PACE. CITR was at the vigil at Grandview Park, and first, to give some background, we spoke with a member of the board of directors of WISH.
So, could you tell me who you are and why is the MAP van important?
Okay, well, my name is Liz Wynott, and I am a member of the board of directors of the WISH Drop-In Centre Society, and the WISH Drop-In Centre Society, in partnership with PACE Society, several years ago set up this program, which is an overnight traveling van that travels the routes that women work the streets in Vancouver and makes them safer. And it was set up partly in response to all the disastrous things that have happened to women, the missing women, the Picton trial, and it was set up with a lot of support from various levels of government, but without ongoing funding. And so it was the van itself has staff, and some of the staff are actually women who previously worked on the street, called peer, sort of a peer program, and it's been well studied, and we know that it engages with women, it helps them get more access. These are the women who are the very most marginalized, the very least likely to use the services that we have set up in fixed areas, and so they get linked in and they get health services and other kinds of things that they need. And And for one reason or another, it's hard to know exactly, probably to do with the election, to do with the deficit, to do with all that. The government has pulled back from providing even short-term funding, and there is no ongoing funding for this program. And so the society, which makes its money through donations largely, and runs a drop-in, the wish drop-in, is really unable by donation alone to keep it going. So there's a very large charitable component to Wish, and Wish has been very successful in getting a lot of support from individuals everywhere. But that's the core program for Wish is actually dropping, where we feed like 7 nights a week, and where we're trying to expand health services and so on. And we really just could not sustain the van without really strong government support.
Do you think that, from the perspective of the government, that they're part of the issue? The support of the van has increased, or do you think the public has just sort of, its attention has lapsed, or what do you
I don't want to speculate. I think that at the moment, once an election is called, the people that work for the government get very much more constrained because they have to wait till the new government's in place before they know how the budgeting is going to go and what they can do. So that they're not, there are some sort of timing issues, I think, that are related to this. And then, of course, it's just generally poor timing because many governments don't feel they have the flexibility that they had before, and it'll take some time for the revenues to pick up again. The problem is, though, that we see this is $250,000 a year program, and we reckon that, compared to, for example, tens of millions of dollars, or maybe $100 million that was spent on the Picton trial, it's peanuts. And that's a question of priorities. And one way or another, the women that we see are going to interface with our sisters. They are at very great risk. Just because one predator has been found, it doesn't mean there aren't a lot more. They're at risk for all sorts of issues related to addictions, infectious diseases, and all those kinds of things. And one way or another, we're going to end up having to deal with their issues down the line. And this is one sort of relatively efficient, passionate program that should not be part.
So, what role does the city government play? The city government has espoused that they support harm reduction. This is
Government people at the municipal, federal, and provincial level have for many years been those people that have enabled the band to operate for 5 years. What's happened is they've come to a crunch where they're not able to help anymore. So I don't want to say that no government has supported it. That's absolutely not true. It has definitely been supported through a lot of hard work on the part of the Wish executive director and other people, but also a lot of hard work by people who work, city staff, provincial staff, and federal staff. And it is very much supported by police, sort of emotionally supported by a lot of people. It just seems that we fall through a kind of a crack which has turned into a chasm, and we want it to be reestablished.
So, talking about the particular group that the van services, why is this group so left in the gaps? Why aren't they being targeted by other support services in the city?
Well, I think there are support services that target women, but you know, we seem to be very good as a society in producing more and more victims. Most of the women are people that have at one time or another suffered significant trauma in their lives. They come from all backgrounds, and they find themselves in a desperate situation of selling themselves. It doesn't seem as if this is an issue that as a society we've ever been able to really take care of. So I think that there's constant sort of effort by advocacy groups and efforts to the extent of streams to provide service, but the issue is really
a diverse group of supporters also attended. Here we hear from a therapist and a burlesque dancer who came with the rest of her troupe, Girls on Top.
I'm a therapist, and I am here because the programs that I used to run for street kids who were working on the street are all closed now. And some of the women that are out there now are people that were probably kids when I was doing that. And I know for sure that they're not safe. And it's really, really important to me that some recognition is given from the government and from the public that these women are constantly at risk. And the MAP ban is the only place where there's any money given towards the actual day-to-day safety of the most vulnerable women.
So you see this as part of a larger problem of losing key social services in Vancouver?
Absolutely. Absolutely it is. And it continues to be. And as they get driven farther and farther from the really obvious parts of the city, they're more and more invisible and more vulnerable.
What's driving them away from the downtown?
Politics. So, you know, the street women have always been the most unsafe, and our city is spread around. In some ways, we would like to think that the only place that bad things happen is in the downtown east side. It happens all over the city. And the MAP ban is the only place where that's recognized. It's really important.
Why aren't other sort of support services in Vancouver addressing this need?
There's no money, and even WISH has very little. It does not have support money for this program. So, you know, being on the road, being on the street, being visible is not popular.
Tell me about the MAP van, what it is, and what it provides to the residents of Vancouver.
Well, from what I'm aware of, the MAP van is an essential services van that goes around between the hours late in the night, like 8 till about 6 in the morning, and they go through the downtown east side to give sandwiches and counseling options and all kinds of really great services to some of the ladies and gents who walk the streets. The Campbell government has cut the funding for this really essential service because a lot of the survival sex trade workers, they don't go into the center to get help. So the MAP van, they will approach and they can talk about counseling options if they have substance problems. They can talk about getting into shelters. So where they wouldn't go into the center, they will approach the MAP van. And the funding is being cut, so it's gone. So the most vulnerable people really in our society today are not going to have a lot of access to basic health care and counseling options and all kinds of stuff that they otherwise wouldn't get, so they're not going to get.
So without the MAP ban, what will sex workers in Vancouver do? What will happen?
Well, if they have a pimp, then they won't get what they need because they don't go into clinics because of the stigmas. Whereas with the MAP ban, they can see a street nurse, they can talk to a counselor right where they are. They don't have to go anywhere.
And why are you personally here tonight to?
I've come out to support a lot of things since I got back. I was out of the country for a while, and I realized how much I love the East Van community. So I want to do what I can to support it.
And here's our reporter Andy talking to supporter Rachel Marcuse.
Why are you here tonight?
I'm here because it's just really disgraceful that in a city like Vancouver, where we've got a history of the many, many missing women, that one of the most important services in the community for women working in the sex trade has been cut.
And why is this such an important service in the city of Vancouver?
This is the only service that provides sort of harm reduction, counseling, support, whatever services all through the night for women sex workers. They also get most of the reports of the bad dates, so women who have experiences with particularly predatory old Johns who may be on the prowl for additional women. It's a really important sort of prevention mechanism.
And why do you think the provincial government is cutting funding for the MAP van?
Because the provincial government's priorities don't focus on marginalized people. And in an economically uncertain time, it's the services for marginalized people who generally have the hardest time having their voice heard that are the first services to get cut.
What effect do you think the candlelight vigils will have on the service?
Hopefully it'll be picked up by the media, and that's often a good way to influence people in electoral politics. I'm hoping that people will also write to their MLA or to the premier, who doesn't seem to care about women and sex trade. Sort of a combination of various tactics might get the funding restored.
Do you think other levels of government, including municipal and federal governments, have a responsibility to fund programs like this?
For sure. I think there's a lot of pressure put on municipal governments to only get 8 cents on the tax dollar. It's hard for them to be able to provide some of these services, although I think that there is a desire there and there is a lot of good work happening that's being supported by the city right now. There's a role for the federal government as well, but this is the jurisdiction of the provincial government, and it really is them that need to be the first to look to for the funding that's been operating for several years now. That isn't actually a huge amount of money, and that costs, I believe, it's something like $23 per woman per year of the women that they support.
Reporter Sharon Hundle also talked to supporters Allison Felder, Rob Gooday, and Deep Sejaki.
I work in healthcare, and I believe in the value of prevention. And I think this is a preventative service. For every dollar we spend on this, we probably save $1,000 at the other end. So I would like to see this kind of service provided.
Yeah. I think, too, just given the history we have in the city with the murders of women on the street, I think it's unbelievable that this would be discontinued.
And I have one question for you. Why do you feel this program is important to you?
Well, I've been a supporter of Wish for a long time. I do some part-time work for them, and I think that it's important for these women, who are some of the most vulnerable and marginalized in the city, to at least have someone that looks after them on a day-to-day basis, even for a moment.
That's great, When I was reading the program slip, I didn't know myself that it was available every single day of the year, which is key. And for it to just be removed that quickly and that abruptly is devastating.
It's also telling these women that, we do care about you and you matter. You're part of our society and you deserve basic service like everyone else.
Sharon also talked to another supporter, Peter, on what you can do to help.
Now, after this event tonight, is there anything else that the community can do to help out and to get these services going again?
Yeah, I think that it's with anything like this, you have to keep sustained pressure. And people just kind of, so many issues going on, so many critical cuts, a lot of other programs. So if this is really important, you have to write to the press.
Okay.
You have to write letters to the paper and say this is insane. Restore this funding. You have to write to Gordon Campbell. You have to write to everybody. You have to write especially to the government and say you have to restore this fund. And keep the issue in the press so that people are aware of it. And more vigils until the van goes by.
Okay.
And thanks to reporters Sharon Hundle and Andrew Longhurst who helped us put that story together. Now we'll go to meteorologist Alice Wong with your weekend weather report. Alice?
Thanks, Carrie. Here's your weekend forecast for June 26th to June 29th. It's been a bit unsettled this first week of summer, but the weather will become more stable by this weekend. Temperatures will go up again as a ridge of high pressure stabilizes along the BC coast. Friday evening to the overnight, cloudy with a low of 11 degrees. Saturday, a weak cold front passes by the coast, which will create overcast conditions with a 50% chance of showers, daytime high of 19. By Sunday morning, that cold front will have moved off and a ridge of high pressure will establish a period of sunny skies and warm temperatures. Sunday, mostly sunny, high of 19. Monday, sunny with a high of 20. So enjoy the weekend while the sun shines bright. Currently, it's mostly sunny and 19 degrees at YVR. That's your weather this weekend, brought to you by the Storm Club of UBC. For News 101, I'm Alice Wong.
Thanks, Alice. And that's our program. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Megan Tricato produced this radio program. Join us next Friday at 5 for the next edition of News 101. For the entire team, news team here at CITR, I'm Carrie Baptist, and thanks for listening. Coming up next is Hot Mess. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.